Hello, Emily Wright.
Hello, Sam McClary. How are you?
I'm all right. It's Tuesday. What day does that... Well, we know what day that means. It means Tuesday, but it also means it's...
Tech Talk Radio.
Excellent.
After 4 months or whatever of getting that wrong, I finally get it right. Can you do the same for your own job?
Potentially. So I believe I'm Deputy Editor, Head of Content.
Yeah, that's right. And I'm Features and Global Editor.
And welcome everyone to this week's edition of Tech Talk Radio. Today we're joined by Dan Hughes of the RACS and Anthony Slumbers, who is a regular commentator at EG. And we started off the conversation with them about the RICS's report on AI, but it very quickly moved into all sorts of other things before coming back round to AI, didn't it?
Yeah, it was beautifully done, very cyclical,
But have a listen in now. We have to get up close and personal today.
Aww.
Because we have not one guest, but two. You might need to be closer than that. I know, I've just had coffee, sorry.
I'll lean in when I have something to say.
Who said that, lean in? That's Facebook woman, isn't
yeah.
it?
Cheryl Sandberg.
There we go. And whose voice was that? That was the lovely voice of... Anthony Slumbers. Welcome, Anthony.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us again. And with Anthony is our first time podcaster with us. Anyway, Dan Hughes. Hey, Dan.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure. Just in case there is anyone out there who doesn't know who Dan or Anthony is, why don't we hand over to you guys? Just tell us a little bit about yourself. Dan, why don't you kick us off?
Yeah. I work for RICS, and I look after the... we've got a number of data and information products, and I look after the product management for those. And I also look after a piece of work looking at how technology is going to change the sector and what we should do about it, how we react. And I think that all comes under the PropTech banner.
And a prolific tweeter, of course.
Not necessarily in comparison to the people in this room, but yes, I do tweet too much.
And Anthony.
Yes, but you have double the number of followers. I'm Anthony Slumbers. I've been working in PropTech from before it was PropTech, believe it or not. I started the first commercial property real estate site in the UK in 1995. Since then, I've bought and sold a number of tech companies writing software. So I spent about 15 years actually writing software. Today, I mainly consult on the impact of technology on the wider real estate market.
You have a lovely voice, but you might need to lean a little bit further forward. Now, I'm just keeping an eye on the sound bars, and you're a little bit quieter than everybody
okay.
else. I don't want anyone to miss a word you say.
So we're here today, I guess, really to focus on the outcome of the RACS report that said AI could potentially take over 90% of the maybe more mundane jobs that surveyors do. And I think this whole industry loves to talk about AI and because they can kind of understand it, but I think it would be good to have a discussion around exactly what is AI and do people use that term correctly all the time, and then what impact it will have for the negative and for the positive. Dan, any thoughts on that original warning?
Yeah, I think so at RICS we do a number of thought leadership papers on topics, and this is one that we commissioned Remit Consulting to do for us. I think it's a great piece of work looking at what might happen in the future. And as you said, some of the numbers coming out around 90%. But I think that's looking at all technology impacting all parts of the job, and it's looking at what might happen as opposed to what is definitely going to happen. So I think one of the outputs that comes out is that the parts of a job that are quite mundane and process-led and data-driven are most likely to be replaced by technology. And on the other side of things, the ones that are a bit more about having a physical presence, about human interaction, the skills, is much less likely to. So I think it's a really good starting point to have the discussion to help people look. The time frame they're looking at is between now and 10 years. Mm. I think one of the other things that comes out of it is there's clearly a slightly different perspective from the survey they did of the rest of the market. So I think there are a number of people who are possibly not quite on the same page of thinking it's the same amount of disruption that's going to happen. And only time will tell, but certainly I think that conversation is something that that needs to happen so people are at least planning for the future?
I think the issue about the survey showing that participants within the industry, I think they came up at an average of 46% of their tasks they thought would be replaceable by technologies, as opposed to 88%, which the survey came up, does indicate that we're really in a world of great threat and great opportunity. I look at it that if you're one of the people who thinks that there's a low chance of you being your task being replaced by robots, you genuinely are under a lot of threat, because the converse is, for the people who embrace all of this, the point is you don't need to outrun the robots in your business. You actually only need to outrun your peers. So the opportunity is that there definitely are going to be a vast swathes of tasks that are automated in certain ways, and a lot of people are going to resist it, but a lot of people are going to embrace it, and the ones that embrace it are unfortunately going to impact very severely on the ones who don't embrace it. So if you want a general what do we do about this, is that you have to embrace this, because as I say, the opportunity is to outrun your peers, not outrun the robots.
And what do we think, how do they outrun their peers? When we talk about AI and automation, what kind of tools should people be looking at, investing money in building? What are those things that can help them succeed?
I think you need to approach it in stages. If we mainly take the AI side, first of all, you need to understand what AI actually is and what it is good at. There's some things that AI is very good at and some things that it's no use. In the same way as there's things that computers are good at and other things that are useless at. There's a thing called Moravec's paradox, which essentially says that Moravec, M-O-R-A-V-E-C.
Character from Game of Thrones.
Yes, exactly. Moravec's paradox essentially says that... King of the North. A lot of the things that humans find really complicated, computers find very easy, and vice versa. So you really have to understand what it is that they are good at. So we can come on to the details of that later. Then you need to get to grips with the whole world of data, and that comes under what is called the four Vs. So it's volume, variety, velocity, and veracity. So it's what data do you have? Is it usable? What other data sources do you need? Who has them? And then what do you do if you don't have much data? And then after you've looked at data, you need to look at what is out there that is freely available. A lot of this stuff is very complicated. You know, you go down the rabbit hole of AI, and it does get very complicated very quickly. But the great thing is a lot of this stuff has become commoditized very, very quickly. You have IBM, Microsoft, and Amazon, and Google, of course, provide an awful
just
lot
that
of
little company.
Yes, just that little company provide an awful lot of on-demand services, in the same way as Amazon AWS allows you to set up your tech stack very easy. Those companies provide off-the-shelf, very, very powerful technology in the background. So there's a lot of things that AI is good at that you can just pick up and piggyback on those services very, very quickly. Then you need to look around. There's an awful lot of individual companies adding services on top of those commodity services. So you need to do your research into who's out there, what are they doing. But then you really have to have a deep dive into your business. After you've understood what AI is good at, what data you have, what services are out there, you then need to be looking at your business. And it's a good idea to look at it with that RSCS report, because it breaks it down to all the different tasks that people in the professions do. And if you just start at the top of that, look at the things that they say are 100% automatable now, look at your own business, and if your own business is only automating 20% of them, it's a pretty good tip that someone is going to come and do it. So do it yourself or have it done to you. So a really deep dive into what your business involves and what technologies you can point at it. And then lastly, I think actually the hardest bit is actually the human bit, because you need to put together an agile cross-functional team in order to implement all this. You know, as the technology gets more advanced, the need for tempering it with human skills gets even greater. You need people who think, people who feel, and people who do. Different skills with different utility. Because AI is a pervasive technology. It will impact on every area of your business. So you must have every area of your business committed and engaged in deciding how best to use it. So if you go down that route, you should be in a... You'll certainly be in a better position than most people, because most people will not go down that route.
Just playing devil's advocate on behalf of somebody else briefly, and I will be listening later actually to Brandon Weber from VTS. And now he was saying that AI potentially is actually something that, you know, property companies need to be aware of, is not being kind of put to them as sort of a bit of a, you know, something that makes it very difficult for them to understand something that's actually quite simple. Do you think that's fair?
I think that's very fair. It's this is definitely a snake oil world. There's an awful lot of things that are dressed up as AI which are not AI at all, and there's an awful lot of overcomplicating things. You know, Einstein's comment about make things as simple as possible, but no simpler is always the best thing to look at. A lot of things don't need a lot of technology.
I'd argue that a lot of the words out there at the moment, so blockchain, AI, machine learning, big data, these are all going to have a massive impact on the industry. But actually, for most people who work in the property sector, we don't need to know too much about it.
Yeah,
it's a little bit like the microchip. So that's transformed how we've been working over the last 10 years, because technology's been around for a long time. There aren't too many people who know the ins and outs of how a microchip works, and frankly, we don't really need to. The important thing is just knowing that the microchip is out there, it's getting faster, and it's having a bigger impact. So we can do things quickly that we couldn't do before. We can connect with people, we can communicate. And so actually, a lot of the technology that's out there, I think people are focusing too much on the individual technologies and arguing about what it is and isn't. And actually, the fact that things are getting quicker, things are going to get automated, and Anthony, I think, gave a great run through there of what people should do about it. I agree with everything he said. I think you could almost simplify it down to actually just be open to the fact that things are going to change. The number of conversations I have around data, for example, where people are fundamentally contradicting themselves within a sentence, that data is the very basis of their business, but data doesn't have any value. And at the same time, data should all be open and free, but I'm not going to share data with anyone. And I'm not particularly sure there is a pure answer that's right for everyone, but that's quite contradictory. So my view would be just to be open and start looking at it and to start questioning some of these things and not worry too much about the ins and outs of the technology behind it.
What do you think is the next step on from what you just said about the contradiction in those sentences? Because I see that from people I've been speaking to, and I'm sure that you would agree, but feel free not to. not trying to lead you down a path there. That's one of the major stumbling blocks up ahead. Is this, you know, idea that yes, it should be open and free, but no, I'm very protective over my own data and that kind of thing, which is less about the technology and more about an attitude. How's that going to change and shift? Otherwise, we're going to be banging our heads against a data wall.
I think you need to do both. It's an understanding of what data is actual real competitive advantage long term. And there's a lot of data that people hoard within this industry that really should just be open. You know, who owns that building? Who's got a lease there? What the hell is for sale? You know, because you just...
Everything's for sale, Anthony.
It's all about the price. But if you think of just the friction involved for a consumer who wants to go and consume some of our industry's products, so they want an office, it's a nightmare at the moment. And it's ridiculous. It's a nightmare at the moment. It's not a nightmare in the residential industry. You can go and find anything on the market. In the commercial industry, you just have to really try hard to find anything in the industry. Now, that information is hoarded by lots of people because it is seen as a competitive advantage, but it's such an anti-competitive advantage. It's just a big piece of friction in a market which would be much better for everyone if you got rid of that. Against that, there's a huge amount of genuine domain-specific knowledge, which is a major competitive advantage for people, which is in people's heads, experience, the reality of what happens when you try and do A or X meets Y. That is genuine competitive advantage. And so I think what is going to happen is one of the sizable agencies, you know, the JLLs, the CBREs and whatnot, is going to break ranks and is going to look to really aggressively apply technologies to their data which has a genuine competitive advantage, and they're going to start giving away the stuff. As soon as someone gives away all the market data which should be given away, that changes the whole system. So, but it needs someone brave enough to say, I don't care, I'm going to make my money elsewhere, so I'm just going to throw that out there. And that cuts off the business model at the knees of lots of people. And then concentrate on the huge added value that they can add to genuine competitive advantage. The great paradox of all this technology is the more interesting the technology is, the more human you need to be. So you have sort of exponential technology and you need exponential humanity, because tech is getting more and more complicated, and the tech is going to do what the tech is going to do. So what are humans going to do? Well, humans have a huge amount of, going back to more of X paradox, loads of things that they can do that computers can't, and they have a huge amount of domain knowledge. And I think if companies start thinking, what is real genuine competitive advantage in our data, and how can we add our human skills on top of that and add technology to the data, our human skills, that will be genuinely disruptive. Because in a market where everything is closed, you don't actually get anywhere. It just stumbles along as it is.
Yep, I agree. I think data is oversimplified when people talk about it, because data is quite a complicated topic, and actually it's almost down to common sense. So data, the quality of data depends on who's created the data, what you know about it, how up to date it is, what it's being used for. So actually one data set can be very high quality for one application and very low for another. So to give you an example, if I go back to I used to work for Ordnance Survey, if you look at something like Google Maps now, that is just awesome. It really is. And if you were looking for going to somewhere, travel directions, then it's brilliant. If you're doing a planning permission, you don't actually know quite how up to date that is. So you would tend to use something like Ordnance Survey data, which is more up to date and it's more accurate. And so for different applications, one is a suitable data set and one is the other, and it doesn't mean either are good or bad. I think that the property industry generally talks about data as one big amorphous lump of stuff, and I actually think that's why people know inherently some of that should be given away free, some of it should be held onto. They don't really want to think about which is which, so they just hold on to everything. So for me, it's a relatively common sense discussion about what data sets are valuable, and as you're saying, the competitive edge. And I think the other thing I'd say about data is it's not always in, if it's available elsewhere or it can be created elsewhere, technology is very good at creating data, then it's not necessarily within the company's powers to hold on to it anyway. So I would say that there are some conversations going on at the moment where data is being held onto because it's the main differentiator, but actually it's going to be created or held somewhere else anyway, so that might not be something that we can be in control of.
And surely this industry always talks about it being a people industry, doesn't it? And surely the differentiator, which I think is what you were saying, Anthony, in a much more intelligent way, is the human, and that knowledge base that they have that isn't, you know, binary code, is what will separate companies from each other and give that competitive advantage. I was at a lecture a little while ago, and they were talking about the hippos versus the geeks, and the hippos being the hippocampus, and people, the humans thinking, and the geeks being the data, and that the hippos making a decision on their own got it right 4% of the time or something, definitely single digits, and the geeks on their own got it right 40% of the time, but when you put them together it was more than 50%. So we should be thinking about how you combine those two things, and I don't know if in this industry particularly the sort of self-confessed dinosaurs of it are just struggling to understand how they put it together and are still seeing, you know, AI or technologies that all the robots are coming to get me. You know?
Yeah, well, one of the things that you asked earlier, sorry, Anthony, is about what should companies do now. And I think that if you go back 5, 10, 20 years ago, you would only trust your IT system with a small number of companies. So you would go and buy an enterprise system that would cost an awful lot of money and you put that in place. And what's happening at the moment is because connectivity, security, you could argue cloud computing, it's becoming much more of an ecosystem. And so whatever you buy 10 years ago would have had to last for 5 years. Whatever you buy now probably doesn't need to last as long. And I still think some people are built within the culture of, well, I want to wait for the perfect solution and make that decision. And my view would be, with some pretty sensible caveats, obviously, but my view would be, well, try it. There's not going to be a huge amount of stuff that you can't get out of and isn't going to change. Any technology solution that's available today will either not be around in 3 years or will have evolved a lot in 3 years to be successful. So building a 5 or 10 year plan of the exact product and putting it in place in the same way that you would have done 10, 20 years ago, I don't think will work. So I think now it's just a case of being open to it and having a look at it with a big layer of common sense about it, obviously.
Well, software's never finished, is it? That's the whole point. There is no end point in software. And it's one of the beauties of the way the software industry works now, as opposed to sort of before it was on demand. If you think, go back 20 years, you needed a bit of software, so you wander off down to Currys or whatever, and you buy your Office disk, and you come back and you install it, and then that's the same piece of software that you have for the next 10 years, whereas you buy it now, and it's going to be different tomorrow, and then different the day after, and different day after, which is great, because the point is you. In a lot of systems, it means everyone can be on the latest greatest version of everything, just because you're buying it on demand. But essentially, I think one of the problems that the property industry is really struggling with is actually thinking about the customer, and the thing is that the customer in property is changing. If you just think about the office market, who is the, if you are, I don't know, X big propco builds a building and looks to rent it for 10 years, who's the customer? Well, it's whoever pays your invoice every 3 months. Who's the customer to the WeWork people? It's every single person that walks into their building. So if you start looking at the whole built environment differently and think of it as somewhere where humans do what humans want to do, then if you approach it from the point of view as, well, our responsibility is to enable those humans to do what they want to do in the spaces we provide them in the best way possible, and then work back from there and think, well, what technology do I need to provide that? But then also, what, as you were saying, so how do I combine our human skills with that technology to create a better user experience? Because I genuinely believe within 5-10 years, it's going to be the user experience of the building that is going to be known, and that's where the value is going to be. Now, actually creating great spaces, it's a really tricky thing. You do need a hell of a lot of data. You need a hell of a lot of technology, and my God, you need a hell of a lot of humanity. And some people are good at it, and some people aren't good at it. If you take the number of people moving into flexible workspace at the moment, because it's all of a sudden it's becoming very much the sort of the thing to do, isn't it? Oh, I'm going to open some flexible working space. Now, there's people who are going to be really good at that. And it's, people are going to be really bad at it, because you're providing a service, you're not providing a product. In the same way as there's fabulous, fabulous hotels, and there's shockingly awful hotels, but they can be technically the same. It is the human skills that you have to add on, but you have to start with the customer. And if you do that, that upends everything.
Yeah, I think I agree. I'm still slightly distracted by the fact that you mentioned Windows downloading from a floppy disk in a tech talk.
Oh, God, did I? No, sorry. I actually used to install. Yes.
You used to be a tape, didn't
I'm showing my age.
Punching cardboard. yeah, no, I agree. It is all about the skills, and I suppose you could almost argue it's space as a service, Anthony.
Absolutely.
If only that were copyright today, Anthony. Mm. I mean, we're running a story this week about the growth of flexible workspace, aren't we? And, institutional, the big names of property are seeing it now and investing in it. Obviously, Blackstone investing quite a lot of money in the office group, and British Land now cottoning on to the fact that, oh, actually, maybe we should be a serviced office provider. And so I think, you know, we will see more of that. And I guess, you know, given the, I know you don't like to talk about politics, Dan, but given the sort of political environment we're in, with Lord knows when Brexit will be sorted out, maybe before any of us are drawing our pension, yeah, or dead. But no one's going to make any long-term decisions in that point, so that's only going to fuel more growth of this kind of space. And I guess if our industry is being a bit slow on the uptake of that, then they're the ones that are going to suffer in the long term.
It's also interesting who else is coming into this market. I was reading yesterday about Verizon, which are the big American telco. They are looking to potentially open 150 co-working centres in buildings that they currently own. Wow. And they've suddenly found, oops, we own all this stuff and we don't need it anymore. What are we going to do with it? Well, we're become a co-working provider. So I think you are going to find that there's going to be other people coming into the market who suddenly realise. Or John Lewis also said they were thinking about doing it. And I saw another American site yesterday, something like coworkinginthemall.com. And the idea was for co-working in...
Well, there's a lot of empty malls in America.
That's true. Another thing that that Brandon said, which is relevant because it will be part of this podcast, was we were talking about, you know, how once upon a time there were various mobile phone manufacturers, and now, I mean, there are, but really, you know, there's just the one. And you sort of look back on it and you think, oh, wasn't that quaint, you know, back in the day when, you know, these guys made these phones. And that, you know, if the real estate sector doesn't cotton on quite quickly and do what the likes of British Land are doing, it could be that, you know, WeWork or Google or Facebook just does offices, and it'll be like, remember that back in the day when there were these archaic companies that used to build offices?
Exactly. What was important to them?
I think one of the things that's happened in the last year or two is that big technology companies are starting to focus more on the property sector than they have before. Both in what you're saying about potentially they're good at offering a service, and therefore it's often sometimes a means to an end to supplying other things. But they're also starting to look at, because there's an ecosystem, it becomes a much more attractive sector for them to look at. So historically, pharmaceutical companies or banks would have huge amounts of money, one big order, and you can do quite well. The property sector is comparatively small companies. It's a huge sector, but lots of small companies. Because of the ecosystem, now all of a sudden, actually, you can start selling a need across a much bigger area, so it becomes much more attractive. And Anthony, you've spoken a lot about Google investing in, or Sidewalk Labs, which is part of Google in Canada, starting to look at space, building a town from the internet up, I think is what they were saying. And you've got a lot of companies who are starting to come into this space who specialise in technology, or they specialise in servicing and providing a service. And so actually it opens up the field much more for other companies to come along. So I think you're right, that the companies that are best placed to capitalise on the change are the property companies that are incumbent. But at the same time, there are a lot of other companies who are quite good at some of the other skills that are needed as well.
And was it you, I think it was you, Anthony, saying that, you know, of course, these companies now, they're not coming at this cold. They actually have huge portfolios that they're managing with their own software, you know, and not just, you know, a few buildings here and there, but huge campuses and portfolios. So, you know, whereas maybe 5 years ago, 5, 6 years ago, it would have been a bit of a, cold call type scenario.
Exactly. When you've got the likes of, Lord knows how much space Google have, but it must be millions of square feet. Facebook have got millions of square feet. Microsoft got millions of square feet, and it gets back to that thing that they have a big problem that they have to solve themselves, and they've got rooms full of engineers, so they have the toys to play with. They have a need, and it's then digital. Once it's digital, it's replicable, scalable at no cost. So I think definitely as the requirement has got stronger, and as the technologies have changed the way, as I always say, not the way we work, but the work that we do, it's requiring different types of spaces. And then people are thinking, well, actually, what we have our portfolio at the moment just simply doesn't work. There's an article in some American publication yesterday talking about CBRE supposedly using lots of AI to reconfigure clients' needs. But it was a great example of slightly snake oil, actually, because it was what they were doing wasn't actually very clever. But all that they were saying is how to, in a world where companies come and go so quickly, what's the typical life of a FTSE 100 company? 12 years or something like that. Fortunes ebb and flow so quickly. So space requirements are a lot less linear. They sort of go up and down. And essentially all the CBRE report was saying, most of them are now taking account of, if they were taking 100,000 square feet of fixed space before, they might think, oh, let's only take 70 of fixed. And then we have flex space. And then the interesting part of the article did go on to say, well, will that change the way office buildings are designed? So instead of designing an office building where you have it completely for long let, you might have to keep a few floors back as co-working, because you need to provide the flex space within your building for your other main tenants, who might only take 70,000 instead of 100. They'd probably pay you more per foot for the 70 if you can provide them with the flex space, so they can go up and down, which again gets you back to, well, what is a landlord then? Well, a landlord's a service provider. They're not just a rent collector. So everything is moving towards providing service, which is the great thing, because property is a people business. They're nice people to be with. If they can get their head around the idea that they're providing a service, and then they get someone, as Dan said, the tech, as long as you understand that, I need a car, so someone go and get me a car, and I need to know what the petrol consumption is, so someone make sure I can find that out, and then boom, I've got that. Add the human skills on top, it's going to be necessity.
I think that takes it quite nicely full circle to back to the RSCS report, which is one of the things they identified in there was about the growing use of building data or availability of building data. So the Internet of Things means that everything's connected, so you can start measuring things. BIM in particular is about, it's effectively building a digital twin for the real world. Mm-hmm. You have an online version, and that really helps you to manage space better and to service it better. And a great example, which we've already mentioned, is WeWork. So they invest very heavily in BIM models for the buildings that they work in. And actually, I would say that probably that's one of their differentiating things, is quite how much they put into the investment in technology up front to allow them to do some really clever analysis about how people are using their spaces and improve it. So it's always an ongoing, increasing and improving model. So I think there's an example of companies like WeWork, who maybe not a technology company, but are really embracing technology to allow them to do something in a slightly different way from their competitors or traditional competitors.
Well, they're an end-to-end digital company, in the sense of, again, one of my hobby horses is get rid of the IT department, in the sense of get rid of this thing that is just exists in one part of your business. The technology, as in Amazon don't have an IT department, but they have IT and technology embedded at every department. So it just becomes, I hate the millennial thing, but it is a bit like the millennial who just thinks, well, what do I do? I'm watching the telly, but at the same time I'm going to be on my laptop and on my phone, and saying it's just what you do.
Do you think that's
like muscle reflex.
Do you think that does raise a problem for this industry though, that I don't know that we have the people that have those kind of skills in this industry. And, you know, like, do we need chartered surveyors or do we need data scientists in the future? And
I would say yes.
Yes, we do need surveyors.
Your report says both.
To both, yeah. So there's no question that data is going to become more and more prevalent. So people are going to either have specialist skills to look at it, or the role of a surveyor will be to at least interpret and understand some of that data. My view is that surveyors will be, well, professionals generally will be around, and technology has been around for many, many years. Roles have evolved, and I think that's just going to continue. It is a little bit different because I think things are happening quicker, and as an industry, we don't always move that fast. And so actually there's a need for us to speed up the change and embrace things a little bit quicker.
Do you think that means different training? Should real estate university courses be... do they need to be ripped up and rewritten so that we're learning new skills?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think necessarily ripped up and rewritten. I think evolving.
I'm being dramatic.
I think they can be evolving. So I think if you look across RICS competencies, for example, so data is becoming much more prevalent in those, and there's a consultation looking at new data skills. But if you look at beyond RICS at training courses or conferences. I mean, at EG, you're very involved with a lot of the conferences at MIPIM and MIPIM PropTech, and you can see technology coming along there. And part of that is about attracting a new audience of the technology people coming in, but part of it is also making people aware and helping to upskill and inform the in vertical commas, more traditional sector about what's happening. And I think that that's just an evolution that needs to happen. I think the one concern I've got is whether the industry is fast enough to do it, because things haven't changed hugely for years and years. And it's starting to change quicker and quicker.
I always think, is the built environment, is all the places and spaces we go to perfect? Well, the answer is nowhere near, is it? It's nowhere near. There's almost nowhere you go during the day that you don't think, cool, this space could be better, this place could be better, it could be better. Better design, better
could be
architect,
cooler in
better
here, for example.
Could be cooler there. There is so much wrong with the built environment, just on a technical basis of, does it provide the greatest experience and the greatest service to the people who use that space? And the answer is no. Well, who needs to sort that out? Surveyors need to sort that out. That's what they do. Their job is the built environment. So when the built environment is perfect, there's going to be no work for surveyors to do. But we're nowhere even close to that. So there's massive amounts to do. But the really interesting thing in Dan's report, which he said, what did he say? You have to be data scientists or customer, did he say customer service? Or
it's about creativity, I think. Was
yeah, it said, you know, it's a data side or you're a front-end side looking after your customers. So one side of surveyors are, I think, going to concentrate much more on understanding what it is their customers want and understanding what's wrong with the space. You know, because loads of people can go into a space and just go, wow, this is fantastic. Or you go into another space and you go, oh God, it's a bit horrible in here. There's very few people who can actually tell you why it's horrible. Because there is a reason. It's going to be, you know, it's a bad design. What does that mean? It's, you know, the temperature's wrong, or the colour's wrong, or the texture's wrong. Not many people know that. That's a huge skill. And it's a huge skill to be able to sit down with a customer and actually really understand what it is they want. And that's maybe the skills, the additional skills that our surveyors are going to need to do, which is back to the human thing. So you've got to really beef up that and really beef up the back end. And don't worry about there not being anything to do.
And I mean, it sounds like surveying of the future, of the now that it probably needs to be, can be, you know, a really interesting job. And I think, you know, we here at EG try and do a lot to encourage the next generation. And it sounds like if surveying is sold in the way that we've just described it, why wouldn't the next generation want to be a part of that?
It's quite a sexy business, isn't it?
They get to be creative, they get to deal with
tech.
You're
at the heart of everybody's life.
I agree. and more so, actually, some of the slightly more boring elements of the role actually are going to be replaced by technology, so it becomes more attractive. I'm really optimistic about the built environment and the role of surveying and other roles in the industry. My only concern is that some people are really engaging, embracing that, which I think is going to be fantastic and it's really exciting. I think some people are probably not engaging with it and thinking about it enough, and I think that's where the turnabout time for some of these things is quite quick, and so you could quite quickly be seen as being left behind, I think. So,
except I think it's really interesting if you look at the growth in flexible working. I think I read yesterday something like 15% of take up in London the last year has been flexible working space.
I think I might know where you read that.
That's in your article, isn't it? It is in your article, as opposed to. It was only a few percent a couple of years ago.
The trend has been since 1984, little uptake and then a dip down, little bit of an uptake every few years, until 2015-16, where it shot up, and then in 2017, in the first half, it's shot up even more.
Right. Well, that could be really interesting, because perhaps, seeing as most things work on an exponential curve at the moment, perhaps we're just on that uptick. Mm. Now, if you're just on that uptick, first thing is you're going to go from 17% to 30% before you can blink. But also the whole thing is so self-reinforcing. I think you could go back 10 years and think about offices one went into, even sort of posh offices. They were still offices, you know, you just, as opposed to you go into the Office Group or you go into WeWork or you go into a Fora or something like that, and you suddenly think, my God, can offices be like this? I didn't realise you could come to work and actually work in something like this. And I think as it gets a bigger slice of the market, more and more people are going to say, why are we still here? Why haven't we got this? Why haven't we got it? Simply because people are getting exposed to, frankly, a better built environment. And you get a tipping point, touch wood, and then...
I think that's true. Sorry, and yeah, no, I completely agree.
Not on a podcast.
I think, yeah. Point taken. I think the other thing is that consumers, people who occupy buildings, their needs are changing because their home lives are changing. So, you know, you can go home and talk to Alexa about turning lights on and ordering shopping and playing music, and you've got your mobile phone and you work on the train, and so actually people's expectations are very, very different. And as technology replaces some of the more mundane sitting at a desk, typing away, doing stuff, you need more spaces to talk and engage and use those human skills. And I think one of the things that co-working spaces does very well is it introduces all of those human type environments that you can then work in. And there's some really extreme examples of where you've got some of the best technology people in the world working in terrible offices just because they kind of can. They're not particularly money driven sometimes. They just want to be in an environment where they're doing something great and it's a good space to interact. And so it starts changing the purpose of an office or the expectations. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned things like attracting the next generation. I think that's going to become more and more important, is the way that you attract people into a role isn't necessarily about the more traditional, well, here's a building, you turn up from 9 to 5, it's a job for life and you get paid X amount of money. I think it's going to be much more about the variety, the contribution that you make, the environment you work in, the humans that you're talking to and interacting with, and the interest, which I think is great, because I think that's a much more exciting place. But I think that technology is, none of that's technology related, but that's all underpinned and enabled by technology.
Where does that leave the more traditional sort of older buildings that you know, can't be converted to that flexible space, or can every space be converted? And what does it mean for anyone who's not working in a city? You know, can they still get that kind of experience? Because I think quite often when we talk about tech and flexible offices and the evolution, we're all really thinking about London or the big regional cities.
So I live out in the sticks, so I come from a slightly different perspective. But I think it's not so much about co-working spaces, it's about flexibility. Yeah. And co-working spaces are a large part of that flexibility. So so people are more increasingly, they're working from home. Or if you go on the train, you can get a commute in. So I've got quite a long commute. Everyone's sitting there with their mobile phone or their tablet or their laptop or whatever it might be. And so actually, for me, it's about flexibility. So old buildings, technology is allowing those to be much more flexible for different spaces. So I don't think every building needs to be, personal opinion is they don't need to all be co-working spaces, but they do need to have the technology infrastructure to be able to support people to do their jobs.
But mobility has sort of solved the problem for old buildings in the sense of everything we do is wireless. So you can sit in a Nash Terrace perfectly well, as long as it's got a nice big fat pipe in the in the front door. Away you go. And a lot of these spaces are, I think the interesting, it's interesting if you look at some of the really some of the best co-working spaces around the world. So many of them are in actually old, really distinctive buildings. There's a fantastic one I saw recently, which was in a converted banking hall. You know how in London most of the banking halls are converted into restaurants and bars and all that sort of thing. Well, this was one converted into a co-working space. It was magnificent, marble columns, 30-foot high ceilings. And you think, if you've got to come to the office, and going back to be exponentially human, you need your space. You know, if you had Josh Artis in here, you'd go on explaining in great detail how the built environment affects us.
We had Josh in here last week. We'll be running that podcast the week after this one. Yeah,
oh, excellent. Well Josh is fantastic on that. There's a lot of the stuff that we sort of just know, he sort of explains why you don't. But it's true. We all have spaces that are the best places to work, and a lot of those are, well, they're character counts.
Hmm. Nodding again.
Sorry, I'm nodding. I agree.
Well, on that note of complete agreement.
Yeah, I guess we should finish. We usually finish up with a few quick fire questions, don't we? Mm. With things such as your favourite technological advance, and your one something that people are talking about all the time that really irritates you.
This could add an hour. No, you start. I haven't thought yet.
So I think I'm duty bound to say data, because that's a bit of
that
a cop out that I love. I've for many years I've worked with data, and in the last couple of years it's become a credible job title rather than something that people walk away from you at a dinner party. But it's a massive topic, and data is going to be the huge thing that drives all of the decisions, all of the everything in the market. So for me, it's about an increased understanding. An awful lot of the data stuff that's around at the moment has been around for 10, 15 years. It's not really new. And I guess the second thing is artificial intelligence, which actually I think is great and is going to have a huge impact. But at the same time, I think that focusing on artificial intelligence, looking at where we'll be in 100 years with robots walking around who are emotionally as good as humans, I have no idea if that's possible. I don't think that's going to change the property sector in the next 5 years. I think it's about the analysis that happens behind, and some of that might be machine learning, some of that might be artificial intelligence, some of that might just be using a spreadsheet in a better way. So I think artificial intelligence is used too often.
Okay, I think the thing I enjoy the most probably is my phone. I just love my phone. I do so much on it, can do so much on it. There's precious little that I do nowadays that I cannot do on my phone. And if I include it on my tablet, then there's really very, very few things I can't do. I love being anywhere and suddenly thinking, oh my God, I need to know X. And there it is. I just went out the other night in Farringdon somewhere. Came out, it was pouring with rain. Farringdon to get to Waterloo is a real pain. How the hell do I do that? City mapper, bish bosh, that's the bus I need. That's where you can get it, and it's going to be there in 2 minutes. You just think, this is just fantastic. You know, it drives me mad. Actually, this might as well be the thing that I don't like. I really don't like people moaning about, oh, we spend too much time on our phones and all, don't we talk to each other, and you know, it's going to make you inhuman and all that. It's such complete nonsense. You have all the world's information in a supercomputer in your pocket. How is that not a great thing? That is a feature. It is not a bug. If it is a bug to you, you're doing something wrong. So there's that, and actually, millennials.
You hate millennials.
I hate the word millennial.
I'd like to distance myself from that comment.
I hate the notion that millennials like this. I don't think it's true at all. So, millennials want cool places to work. We all want cool places to work. Millennials only want to work on their laptops. That's the way we all want to work. It's just It's a life stage thing. People in when they're 22 are different to when they're 52. It just always it is the case. And people change with technology. Technology enables all of us. So supercomputer in the pocket, fabulous.
Brilliant. I guess one last question for me. So it may not have gone unnoticed, but EG has recently tied up with Pi Labs to launch a competition where we're asking people out there who are in tech and a relatively young startup to enter the competition for a chance to win up to £150,000 of investment, which is quite nice. We both said we'd quite like that, didn't we? But just wondered from you guys, what kind of things you'd like to see people submitting to that competition?
I'd like to see people submitting AI. I honestly do think it is an overwrought and overused word, but there's going to be some really, really cool, very, very powerful things that come out of AI. But this is serious AI. There are different levels of AI, and it's hot. I'd like to see some really hardcore stuff, because I think you could do some really, really interesting things with it.
Yeah, and my dislike wasn't AI. It was the word, the misuse of the word AI. I agree with that. I think the other thing is that there's a lot of talk of disruption, and I'd be very excited to see people talk about disruption when it is truly disruptive. And if it isn't disruptive, which is great, an awful lot of really good things can happen that aren't disruptive, they're not being talked about. So I think there's just so much opportunity across the whole sector that anything that comes up is probably good.
Okay, brilliant. Well, thank you for joining us. Apologies about a room that is hotter than the sun. Well done for surviving it. And
pass out later.
Yeah. thanks for joining us on this week's Tech Talk.
Thank you.
So there we have it, and some ideas from them on what they'd like to see if you are thinking about, and you should be, entering our Tech Talk Academy, the competition we're running with Pi Labs. Should you want more information on that, please do go to www.egi.co.uk/news/Tech Talk Academy. Or if you can't remember that, email us at techtalk@egi.co.uk.
Listening to that, I don't know how you ever don't remember your job title. I mean, that was quite a mouthful.
Maybe because I'm saying that more than my job title currently. But Anthony and Dan weren't our only guests this week, were they? You went and met the very lovely and wonderful
Brandon Webber, from VTS. So he was over for 3 days, and 3 days only, and he was fighting jet lag, and it was pouring with rain. Classic British summertime, so we apologise to him for that. He's over from New York to have a chat about VTS 7 months, I think it's 7 months on from the Hightower VTS merger, and also to actually, interestingly, chat around some things that Dan and Anthony touched upon. It must just be that those are the themes at the moment. So we talked a lot around AI and what that means and what it doesn't mean, and how if you hear the mention of AI, then beware, because it might actually be something to sort of not maybe unintentionally make things more complicated than they need to be. And we talked a lot around flexible office spaces and agility, and Brandon was saying, gone are the days of, and again, Anthony and Dan were saying this, gone are the days of, long-term planning. And actually, a company doesn't normally even think beyond a quarter at the moment. So when you've got companies not thinking beyond a quarter, why are they going to take long leases? And I know that for lots of people listening, this won't be anything particularly new, but I think that flexible office space, whilst it's not new, is building momentum at a speed that I don't actually think anybody was expecting. It's responsible for 15% of uptake in London in the first half of 2017, and if you look at the stats, you can see that the uptick that we're seeing is not just a bit more than what we've seen cyclically over the years since 1984, which is when the data goes back to, but it's huge. So we were talking about that, and so it was short and sweet, this podcast, but this is what Brandon had to say.
This is Emily Wright, Features and Global Editor of EG, and I'm joined today by Brandon Weber, Chief Product Officer of VTS. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Loving the English summertime.
Love it. Yeah.
Obviously, it's pouring with rain.
Well, it's 95 degrees in New York, so actually, I'll take the cool weather.
Oh, well, yeah. Obviously, you are over visiting for 3 days.
Yeah.
So how's it all going? It's 7 months on from the VTS Hightown merger.
Yeah.
How are things?
Good. Yeah. Tough, challenging, rewarding. We're a little ahead of expected, I think, when we kind of reflect on where we wanted to be halfway through the year. Thinking across technology integration, merging the two cultures and coming out of it with a really strong unified culture, mm-hmm. making the leadership team work really well and organize the company in a way for us to really kind of hit 2018 running and achieve scale. So sit back, I'm feeling proud of the work that we've done so far.
Good. And it's exciting news last week. So there's so Knight Frank.
So we released a press release announcing a new partnership, a client relationship with Knight Frank, which is really special for us because, frankly, I remember my first meeting with Knight Frank. I think it was like almost 2 years ago now, actually it was about a year and a half ago, and for us now to come to this place with them, where they're really investing big in modernizing their kind of entire infrastructure around the brokerage business. And to choose us as a partner to help them do that is awesome. It feels like a great success, and we feel lucky to have them as a partner.
Great. And we've been talking this morning about various things, and it's sort of almost been like a whistle-stop tour through the current state of play in the tech sphere, which is no mean feat. But one thing that we were talking about, which is interesting because it's something that we've been looking into, is this idea of, flexible cities and flexible working and agile mm-hmm. working. Mm-hmm. And I think we were saying there's actually a lot of noise around tech at the moment, and there were several key issues underpinning it, which businesses need to be aware of.
Yeah.
So in terms of that idea of flexible workspace and how that links in, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, well, first, maybe I'll comment on the noise. I think it's noise when it's not connected to interesting business problems or ideas, right? And like that to me is how I define noise. Like when you're having a discussion, at the end of the discussion, there isn't like a fundamental like either business idea or problem that we're talking about, then like let's eject that and stop talking about it. I'm excited to move past that kind of noise. I think one of the interesting business problems that the industry needs to grapple with and may not be grappling with as proactively as it should be is this like very real disconnect now between the agility of a modern business, like how quickly it has to make decisions. I mean, most modern businesses, and I'm not talking about technology companies, they are literally thinking about their strategy on a quarterly basis now, not even an annual basis, or a five-year plan. The notion of a five-year plan for even the new traditional company, like the company that's traditional but in this day and age, is crazy. It's the world's going to change. So everything's accelerated, right? We all feel it every single day with the tech that we're using. And yet, the commercial property industry, in terms of the expectations they have for long lease lengths and all that stuff, have not changed at all. So that is a irresistible force, immovable object kind of problem, and we need to go and reconcile it. And what we're seeing now is the birth of kind of a new set of companies, the serviced office. Serviced office have been around a while, but it's expanding rapidly now under the guise of, the office group or WeWork, et cetera. And it's serving a need that I think is just going to be an institutional need going forward, which is every company in kind of the future, or even the present going forward, has a part of their portfolio, their business, that just needs to be highly agile. It's going to be growing and shrinking in real time. So the notion of flexible space isn't a, it's not a nice to have anymore, right? And we were with a group of very smart property owners, some of the largest in the United States, and one of the leaders of one of those property owners basically said that they're planning, they're working into their operating plan the notion that 25% of their property is just flexible space. Whether that's flexible space branded under WeWork or it's their own white label, that is actually more beside the point, right? The point is that 25% of their office stock could be on monthly leases or annual leases. They'll charge a premium for it, but their big clients need it, not the little startups like the IBMs of the world need that kind of stuff. And I think that's something that if you're listening to this and you're the head of asset management or CEO of a property company, and that's not like kind of top on your agenda, like, okay, how do we provide that agility for our customers? You're going to see companies just kind of run past you and win the deal where that's really important.
Do you think that if people listening to this who fall into those categories, you know, do you think enough of them are already thinking that way?
Not yet. It's a distant, I think the majority of the industry, especially on the, you know, on the ownership side, I think is still thinking of this as there are some companies doing this and should we think about having them in our buildings as tenants and what are the pros and cons of that, which that's not even the problem, right? Like those companies exist because there's a growing need from their customer, right? The tenant, the organization. And so I think that's where they need to start. They need to ask the question, do we believe that in 5 years, a meaningful percentage of our business needs to be directed at solving that customer problem, which is agility, flexibility, movement. Right? Yeah.
And the other thing that we were talking about, which would be great just to get a couple of your thoughts on, because this is something that has actually had a lot of traction, because we did a piece on Google's parent company Alphabet, the urban innovation on Sidewalk Labs, coming up with this concept of building cities from the internet up, starting with this 12-acre site in Toronto, potentially. Mm-hmm. And you know, if anyone didn't read the piece, the headline was, do we still need real estate developers to develop real estate? And you actually just came up with a really interesting alternative headline, which is like, well, what if the real estate developers of the future are
Google, Facebook, Apple. Yeah, totally. Yeah, I think what's super interesting is that the experiment that Sidewalk Labs is running is an event. It's an interesting like example of kind of, you know, what would a city or a neighborhood or an urban center look like if we just thought about it from the ground up, given in the modern world that we live in. Mm-hmm. Technologies that we need, access to services that we want, leveraging all kind of the latest state of the art. And probably also underpinning that is like taking a customer-centric point of view at every lens. And I don't mean customer like the LLC that's signing a lease. Mm. I'm talking about the human being that's walking into the property to either do work or play or live, right? Those are all just novel ways to start from the ground up, right? So that's an experiment, and they're going to do a lot of learnings, and a lot of things will come out of it that, you know, that steely-eyed developers are like, oh, you could never do that because of entitlements and all sorts of stuff, but it's really a proof of concept. But that underpins, like, what generally starts to happen is that you've got a Google who's, part of the reason they're, you know, Sidewalk Labs is interested in this because they think the built environment's just going to fundamentally change over the next 20 years. Google's interested in this because their number one resource is human capital, right? So they just think about human capital as everything. Everything Google does is kind of human-centric, both in terms of their customer and in terms of their people. So when you look at some corollaries here, like 25 years ago, like the Motorola Razr, you know, was the cell phone of choice, and you know, Sanyo was a big cell phone creator and stuff like that. And then Apple came in and got into the cell phone business, and now we look back nostalgically on, remember, you know, world before Apple was building cell phones. Wasn't that weird? And now Tesla is 8 to 10 years into, you know, maybe giving us a future where we look back and we're like, remember when like General Motors and, you know, and Ford Motor Company and Mercedes were the big, you know, were the big developers? Now, well, maybe it's going to be Tesla and the next generation. Apple's going to go build the car too, probably. So Amazon's doing it now with infrastructure, right? And, you know, maybe in 5 years we're going to be like, remember when we bought groceries that way? Gosh, that was weird. And now Amazon's bought Whole Foods and they're going to change the supply chain. They've built the modern internet infrastructure because they needed to, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not far-fetched to me to have a Facebook or a Google of the future say, gosh, The built environment is this massive aggregation of data. Google's mission is to organize the world's information and make it universally accessible. It wouldn't be surprising to me at all if in 5 years they're like, let's commercialize this. Let's go build, you know, 10 million square feet of property and see what happens.
Well, on that note, let me get to your next meeting, but I think you've given our listeners a lot to think about there. So thanks again for joining me, and thanks for braving the lovely English summertime, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your trip.
Thank you so much.
So there you go, and then he was off back to New York, on which note, in case anybody doesn't have this in their diary, it is New York Real Estate Tech Week from at the beginning of October. I was just about to say from the 2nd of October, and I'm pretty sure it's actually the week after that. As international media partner, we should absolutely know when the dates are. So I'll double check those. But everybody should. So that's with them with Metaprop. Everybody should kind of keep an eye out for that. I think what we're doing here in the UK is really exciting, and I don't necessarily believe that we should always look to America for inspiration, but, you know, the Americans do it well, so keep an eye on that.
And we will, of course, be talking to our partners over there in New York in the run-up to the start of that, when we will have some great interviews being lined up, and hopefully one or two of those voices here on the podcast as well. So do keep tuned, but for now, I guess it is goodbye from me.
Sam McClary.
Oh, I was going to say, and you can say and goodbye for me too, but
we did,
like
we
two
were
Ronnies
so
thing.
Well, and then I messed it up. Do you want to try it again?
Shall we say, I'm just going to say it's goodbye from me.
It is goodbye from me. If it wasn't, this would be an awkward moment. I'd carry on and you'd stop.
I'm just going to walk out the room now.
Yeah, okay. Well, it is hot in here.